parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
The energy crisis in Britain has dragged millions of British people into fuel poverty, and despite July's price cap fall, energy bills continue to be totally unaffordable, leading to an epidemic of negative household budgets. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. The British government has been charged with betraying the most vulnerable in society by seemingly abandoning support for a social tariff that would help households pay for their gas and electricity. Fuel poverty campaigners were left angry after ministers failed to include plans for a social tariff from next spring in energy market reforms, despite commitments in two budget statements. Jeremy Hunt, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, promised to consider a social tariff for energy bills in the autumn statement as part of a pledge to help vulnerable people. In the spring statement earlier this year, the Treasury confirmed the government was developing a new approach to protect households from increasing energy costs from April of 2024, including consideration of a social tariff. Ministers appeared to abandon the plans by failing to raise the option of a social tariff, which would set the price of gas and electricity well below the cap on energy prices, in a wide-ranging set of reforms designed to supposedly strengthen the retail energy market after scores of suppliers went bust. A spokesperson for the Labour Party said, "This is typical of a government that makes promises and breaks them. They are more interested in protecting fossil fuel windfall profits than vulnerable households." Almost 100 charities and non-profit organisations have written to ministers calling on the British government to move quickly to legislate a social energy tariff that would offer vulnerable households discounts on their bills. The plan also have the support of the energy industry and the sector's regulator. Peter Smith, a policy director at the National Energy Action, a fuel poverty campaign group, said, "Failure to even consult on a social tariff would be a betrayal of the most vulnerable in our society and create further distrust in the energy market." The National Energy Action, a fuel poverty campaign group, was one of 95 groups that signed a letter to the government earlier this year calling for a discounted, targeted tariff to be made available to people on existing means-tested and disability benefits, with the carer's allowance alongside those still struggling with their bills but missing out on support from the welfare system. There is widespread concern over low-income elderly and disabled people in Britain being cut off from energy supplies after being forced onto prepayment meters that they cannot afford to top up. Recently, Jonathan Brearley, the chief executive of Ofgem, said there was a case for urgently examining a social tariff that would limit the impact of extremely high prices for a defined set of vulnerable groups. Social tariffs are common in the telecommunications industry, and are also offered by many regional water companies, leading to calls for all energy suppliers to offer them too. Julian Cooper, the head of the energy policy at Citizens Advice, said a social tariff would protect millions of people from excessive energy bills and provide crucial certainty for people who need it most in a new era of high energy costs. Julian Cooper added, the government promised to introduce better targeted support by April of 2024, but with Parliament now in recess, time is running out. Without the introduction of more long-term targeted support, we'll see the same crisis repeat every winter. The government must deliver on its commitment. A government spokesperson claimed the outlook for energy prices had improved significantly and it would continue to monitor the situation whilst keeping options under review, including with respect to the most vulnerable households. Peter Smith said, the recent fall in energy prices was no grounds for complacency. He added, the energy crisis has dragged millions of people into fuel poverty and despite July's price cap fall, energy bills continue to be totally unaffordable, leading to an epidemic of negative household budgets. A spokesperson for Energy UK, which represents the UK's largest energy suppliers, warned that targeted energy bill support could not be pushed back further. He urged the government to put in place a more permanent long-term solution, such as a social tariff, to ensure all customers can afford their energy bills. The Labour spokesperson said, the Labour Party is determined to take action to cut bills for all households, particularly the most vulnerable. We are clear the retail market is not working for those most in need. The British newspaper The Sunday Express has also covered the same story and tells us more. Households across Britain face a second winter of sky-high energy bills due to a lack of gas storage facilities to prevent supply shortages. Days after British gas owner Centrica announced record profits of £969 million, energy experts have warned Britain's continued dependence on imports will put us at the mercy of wholesale price fluctuations. They argue the government has failed to ensure the country is fully prepared for a cold winter, when increased demand for gas and electricity will bring a repeat of the misery suffered last year. Global gas prices soared after the start of Russia-Ukraine war caused supply issues. Analysis by the International Monetary Fund said household budgets here were hit harder than any country in Western Europe by energy costs last year. This was partly because many gas storage facilities were closed in 2017. They are set to be reopened, but Britain can currently only store enough gas to last a few days, while countries such as Germany and the Netherlands can hold enough natural gas to meet months of demand. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak is set to announce fresh investigation in Britain's oil, gas and renewable energy industry. The Prime Minister and Energy Security Secretary Grant Shapps will meet industry leaders in the coming days to discuss boosting homegrown production and storage. But energy insiders fear a harsh winter could leave millions of people unable to pay their bills. They have urged the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Jeremy Hunt, to draw up plans to bail out the poorest households with further subsidies on fuel bills. Leading think tank, the Henry Jackson Society, is also warning the Chancellor of the Exchequer must be prepared to offer further support, with subsidies targeted at people on lower income to reduce the cost of the Treasury. It will say in a report in the coming days, experts agree the winter of 2023-2024 is not going to be any easier than the previous ones. It could be even worse. The report will add, we urge the government to continue with the price caps and similar subsidies for energy bills whenever necessary to help households and businesses survive this winter. Centrica's announcement of record six-month profits for British Gas, up from £98 million a year earlier to £969 million, was met with anger by customers. The surge has been blamed on energy watchdog Ofgem, raising its price cap to allow suppliers to charge more. It currently limits annual bills to £2,074 for a typical household, down from £4,279 in November of last year. The government's energy price guarantee also limits household bills, but this is set at £3,000, which means costs could increase significantly. Industry insiders say allowing bills to come close to the £3,000 mark would leave millions of people unable to pay. Eight-year defense of Iranian combatants.
A senior Iranian lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
The United States post-9/11 wars have displaced at least 38 million people in and from Afghanistan, Iraq, Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, the Philippines, Libya, and Syria. By 30th August 2021, the last American military aircraft departed from Afghanistan, ending the protracted U.S.-led military presence in the country. After the withdrawal from Afghanistan of the U.S. armed forces and the Taliban's ascent to power in summer of 2021, the number of forcibly displaced Afghans rose steeply. Also, the peculiar events leading up to the Taliban's takeover of Kabul intensified instability and violence in Afghanistan, causing even more human suffering and displacement. Violence has been the major factor in involuntary population movements among Afghans. Since 2001, due to these types of circumstances, millions of Afghans have fled the country, primarily to Iran and Pakistan, where they face an uncertain future. Ironically, the migration of Afghans to Iran has been taking place in a situation where Iran itself has been under decades of economic pressure due to the cruel imposed sanctions of the United States and its Western allies. In the past four decades, Iran has welcomed and hosted more than 5 million Afghans, which means it has as many Afghan immigrants as the entire population of countries such as Ireland, Norway, Finland, Denmark, and Serbia. This high volume of Afghan refugees, which mostly have been deprived of formal education and skills training in their home country, can present security challenges for any country. For a closer look and an analysis, please join us on this edition of Iran Today. Afghan refugees are one of the largest displaced populations in the world. In 2023, there were at least 8.2 million Afghans hosted across 103 different countries. They have been driven out of their homes and their country into neighboring countries by conflict, violence, and poverty. It is estimated that 85% of Afghan refugees are living in Iran and Pakistan. with 28.3 million people that make up two-thirds of its population in need of humanitarian and protection assistance in 2023, the severe humanitarian crisis in Afghanistan continues to deteriorate. The prolonged nature of the situation has prompted intensified efforts to support Afghan refugees and the host countries, especially Iran, that has generously accommodated them for over four decades, according to the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. For more information, we talked to External Relations Officer at UNHCR, Ms. Donya Islam Khan.
Iran has the tradition of great hospitality. I mean, Iran's history of hosting refugees does not start from 1980 after the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. Refugees from Poland, from Armenia, Iraq. So Iran has like a long history of hosting refugees and people who are forcibly displaced.
Based on the latest figures communicated by the government of Iran, 762,000 refugees live in Iran, of which 750,000 are Afghans and 12,000 are Iraqis. Additionally, it is estimated that some 586,000 Afghan passport holders with Iranian visas also live in Iran. In 2022, the government of Iran undertook a headcount of all undocumented Afghan nationals in the country, including those who newly arrived following the events that led to the Taliban takeover in Afghanistan in 2021, through which some 2.6 million Afghans were registered. According to Iranian officials, 500,000 undocumented Afghans did not participate in the headcount. It is estimated that since the upheaval in Afghanistan in August 2021, a total of 1 million Afghans have fled to Iran, resulting in an upsurge in international protection needs.
This socio-cultural integration is the biggest privilege that Afghan immigrants in Iran have. They consider this land as their second homeland, and it really is. When you talk to each and every one of them, when you go to see their lives, you'll see what I mean. The Islamic Republic didn't take Afghan immigrants into camps in remote areas far from the urban society of Iran. It never did that.
This is Sayyid Abbas Hosseini of the Afghan Voice Bureau in Tehran. We asked him about Afghan refugees in Iran.
There's no sense of alienation and loneliness here, and this is the greatest advantage that has made Iran the biggest host of Afghan immigrants. Iran is their first choice and priority for all of them. The doors of Iran are open. In any case, Iran has been a safe home for the people of Afghanistan.
In the process, the housing, health, and education of the immigrants has imposed a heavy financial burden on the country, especially in a situation where the Islamic Republic itself is facing economic pressure due to thousands of sanctions by the United States and the Western Bloc.
As for healthcare, given the poverty of most of the Afghan immigrant families, the lack of insurance and etc., they are definitely facing many problems and challenges. But the healthcare system of the Islamic Republic has cooperated, helped, and given discounts as much as possible. According to the most recent statistics provided by the Iranian Ministry of Health, the Islamic Republic spends $500 per year for each Afghan immigrant. That's while Iran receives merely $10 from international aid organizations.
But none of these issues have caused the Iranians to be indifferent to the Afghans or to refer to them as a crisis in the media, compared to the controversy that European countries created a while back by using expressions such as flood, invasion, or swarms of people to describe migrants who are determined to reach Europe in search of security and stability.
In terms of Iran's policies, I have worked in different countries with UNHCR. Iran has one of the most progressive refugee policies. And when we say progressive refugee policies, what does it mean? It means refugee children, Afghan children, regardless of their registration status. And the decree came from the Supreme Leader in 2015 that regardless of refugee status, or documentation status, Afghan and foreigner children can enroll in Iranian school. So this is a very inclusive policy which we advocate elsewhere in different other countries to be practiced and to be enrolled.
Let's not forget that this so-called flood of immigration to Europe was the direct result of Western military interventions and their warmongerings. But they have never been willing to accept the responsibility for it. Moreover, the Afghans are not the only community of refugees and immigrants in Iran. Citizens of Iraq, another country that was attacked by the United States and its allies, constitute the second largest group of immigrants in Iran, which is another story in itself. Mr. Abolfazl Amouyi of the National Security Committee in the Iranian Parliament has more to say.
The fact is that the current situation in Afghanistan is a product of the negative performance of the big powers. The presence of the United States, the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan, and even the promotion of radical ideas in Afghanistan are all the results of the actions of the international powers. And today they must accept the responsibility for the current developments in Afghanistan. But the fact is that we incurred the most costs in this matter. And one of the demands of the Islamic Republic is that those who caused the existing situation in Afghanistan should take action to correct this situation and accept the responsibility and shoulder the financial burden.
In 1979, the West sought the collapse of Afghanistan's Soviet-backed communist regime. Afghanistan witnessed internal clashes between communist parties that replaced each other, prompting migrations and displacement. A civil war followed by the Taliban takeover added to the growing wave of Afghan migration abroad. The U.S.-led occupation of Afghanistan brought millions of Afghans home from around the world. The end of that occupation and return of the Taliban government is now forcing them to leave their homeland again. And based on cultural commonalities and the relative ease of crossing their difficult-to-enforce 900-kilometer border, Iran has always been a preferred destination for Afghans escaping Afghanistan. Meanwhile, over the past few years, politicians, journalists, and ordinary people across Europe have passionately debated what is variably called the refugee or migrant crisis in Europe. In light of this, some Europeans also fear that the recent migrants would threaten the cultural makeup of Europe due to the perceived incompatibility of the Islamic background of the majority of new arrivals. While in the last few years the total number of immigrants who went to Europe has not exceeded a few tens of thousands, but Western authorities have generally referred to it as a refugee crisis and adopted strict security measures against them. In fact, European nations are generally reluctant to take them in. For instance, other than 149,000 Afghans who were taken in by Germany, a distant third compared to the millions in Iran and Pakistan, only a few thousand have been accepted by other European nations.
According to a recent survey in Germany, Afghan refugees are the loneliest segment of German society. The feeling of loneliness and being far from German society, the lack of integration with this society, the racist approach of the Germans towards these immigrants, the way they treat Afghans, the attitude that creates a long process before Afghan refugees can go into German society, you know, they have to live in camps in remote urban and rural areas. All this makes they feel very alone. There have been some cases of suicide, isolation, severe psychological problems. This has all caused many people to express regret. The United States, Germany, France, Britain, we considered them as a utopia and we thought that our dreams would be realized there. But that was not true.
Moreover, in response to U.S. attempts to secure deals with countries to temporarily house Afghan refugees, Russian President Vladimir Putin has rejected the idea of relocating refugees from Afghanistan to neighboring Central Asian countries while their visas to the United States and Europe are allegedly being processed. "We don't want militants showing up here under cover of refugees," Putin was quoted as saying. That leaves the route through Iran into Turkey as the only other option for refugees in northern Afghanistan. Turkey, a key transit route for asylum seekers heading to Europe, has already built most of a planned 241 kilometers, 3-meter-high concrete wall on its border with Iran. This is specifically to stop a potential influx of Afghans entering the country through Iran, because Iranian travelers do not need a visa to enter Turkey.
This is Iran Today. Iran Today is broadcast every week on Fridays and Saturdays. The series analyzes major political, economic, cultural, and social events concerning Iran. So don't miss the opportunity to listen to Iran Today on IRIB English Radio.
It is more than 44 years since the first Afghan refugees left their country in what has become one of the largest and longest displacement situations in recent history. In Iran, thanks to the government's progressive and inclusive policies, refugees have been given access to education, health, and livelihoods opportunities, helping them thrive, not just survive. This is the office of Dr. Amir Ali Karimi, an Afghan orthopedic surgeon who has been working in Iran for years. His office is located in an uptown area in the capital city, a place frequently visited by both Iranian and foreign patients. He shares with us his experience as a successful Afghan in Iran.
I'm Dr. Amir Ali Karimi, an orthopedic surgeon and knee surgery specialist, a citizen of Afghanistan. I was born in Najaf, Iraq, raised in the Islamic Republic of Iran. I started my education from elementary school in Qom. I continued my studies in the field of medicine. I graduated from Shahid Beheshti University of Medical Sciences and then from Iran University of Medical Sciences. I've been an orthopedic specialist since 2006, and I've been serving patients as a subspecialist since 2021. My patients are both from Iranians and Afghan immigrants, and I'm at their service and do what I can for their treatment. If a doctor is successful in a province or a city, it means that their work is very good. I myself have tried my best to reach that ability, to win the trust of patients, to honestly provide them with the best treatment. May God grant us more success. I myself feel that I'm in a situation where my presence is good for the Islamic Republic in many ways. It is good for the immigrants as well, and it is good for me. Maybe if I go abroad, I'll be more prosperous, but I cannot find a place other than Iran where I can feel comfortable, where I can have my own beliefs. No, that's why despite all the problems, I've tried to stay here and do my job honestly.
Newly arriving Afghan asylum seekers largely settle in urban settings, being supported by the in-situ Afghan population, while a smaller number are temporarily hosted in transit centers. And longer-term shelter solutions are being explored by the Islamic Republic government, UNHCR, and humanitarian partners. It is estimated that 99% of refugees in Iran live in cities, towns, and villages side by side with the Iranian host community, including 55% of them in Tehran, Isfahan, and Rezavi Khorasan, while 1% live in 20 settlements managed by UNHCR's main government counterpart, the Bureau for Aliens and Foreign Immigrants Affairs of the Ministry of Interior. The government of Iran is responsible for refugee registration and status determination. The legal status of refugees is defined by two international instruments, the 1951 Convention relating to the status of refugees and its 1967 Protocol. The Islamic Republic of Iran acceded to the 1951 Convention and its 1967 Protocol on 28th July 1976.
The conditions of Afghan immigrants are better in Iran than in many other countries. We do not confine them in camps. They live among Iranian citizens because they share the same language and religion. They have close relations with the Iranians. They have permission to work, and they are present in the Iranian markets. In short, they use almost all the resources available in our country.
As an example, bread is a widely consumed product in Iran. This product is subsidized. It is sold below its real price. But there is no limit to buy bread for Afghan immigrants, and they can benefit from subsidies. Or in case of healthcare, during the coronavirus pandemic, Afghan immigrants used the same vaccines Iranian citizens used. In other words, we provide equal services to these immigrants to a large extent, although this means an additional burden for the government.
In recent years, the Iranian government has slowly introduced policies to increase the provision and renewal of Amayesh cards. Amayesh is a refugee identity card which was introduced in a pilot program for documented refugees in May 2021, which has improved some basic rights, such as access to health insurance and education. It also grants registered refugees conditional freedom of movement and temporary work permits. Also, it's noteworthy that in Iran, primary health care is available for free for both refugees and undocumented people, while Amayesh cardholders can also access Iran's Universal Public Health Insurance Scheme for additional coverage.
Iran has equally very inclusive health-related policies for refugees. Like, Iran was probably among the very few first countries that allowed Afghans to be included in the national health and vaccination plan. So during COVID, Afghan refugees and Afghan migrants who were in the country were receiving services at par with the local population. Again, Afghans in Iran can benefit from the health insurance schemes. So comparing to the many other countries where refugees are not welcomed, Iran leads by example.
Furthermore, all children in Iran have access to primary and secondary education regardless of their status.
Afghan immigrants should not be deprived of education. These immigrants should be honored. This is what the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei, reiterated almost a decade ago. Education for Afghan immigrants was a serious issue. Suppose the constant flow of people coming to Iran and many of them without any education. It was a serious challenge. But in the 2010s, we witnessed a profound change in the presence of Afghan immigrants in the country's education system, in colleges and universities. Families who did not have identity documents obtained residence documents through their children, and their children were able to go to school. And today, according to the latest statistics, about 700,000 Afghan students are studying in the schools of the Islamic Republic of Iran. At the same time, this extensive presence has had challenges for the Islamic Republic. According to statistics given by the Iranian Ministry of Interior, these 700,000 Afghan students incur costs to the tune of $350 million for Iran, which is a significant amount.
The war in Ukraine has grabbed international attention, but global observers, including the UN Refugee Organization, hope that refugees like Afghans in Iran are not forgotten. Because even when the focus of cameras turns away, the original suffering of these people still remains. Therefore, they have called for more international support and burden sharing, especially by those countries who are directly responsible for these catastrophes. 4 decades of conflict and instability in Afghanistan have left millions of people on the brink of hunger and starvation. A record 28.3 million people are in need of humanitarian and protection assistance in 2023, a huge spike from 24.4 million people in need in 2022 and 18.4 million in early 2021. In 2023, 20 million people face acute hunger, with 6 million people in emergency levels, that is one step away from famine, one of the world's highest figures. The impact of the conflicts on women and children has been particularly devastating. Many children are out of school. Malnutrition rates remain extremely high, with some 875,000 children suffering from severe acute malnutrition in 2023 and 2.3 million children and 840,000 women from moderate acute malnutrition. The Afghan population has been pushed to the limit by prolonged conflict, high levels of displacement, the impact of COVID-19, natural disasters, and deepening poverty. Moreover, it has been argued that war's destruction of economies, public services, infrastructure, and the environment leads to deaths that occur long after bombs drop and grow in scale over time. In light of that, there are recent studies that show the causal pathways that have led to an estimated 3.7 million indirect deaths in post-9/11 war zones, including Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iraq, Syria, and Yemen. The total death toll in these war zones could be at least 4.6 million and counting, though the precise mortality figure remains unknown. Of course, some people were killed in the fighting, in which the U.S. government has been engaged in the name of counterterrorism, but far more, especially children, have been killed by the reverberating effects of war, such as the spread of disease. In laying out how the post-9/11 wars have led to illness and indirect deaths, the goal is to build greater awareness of the fuller human costs of these wars and support calls for the United States and its allied governments to alleviate the ongoing losses and suffering of millions in current and former war zones, especially since women and children suffer the brunt of these ongoing impacts.
So amid all this, taking care of the second largest refugee population is not an easy task. Despite all the challenges, Iran continues with its inclusive policies. Now it is the responsibility of international community to match what Iran is doing in the form of more support, in terms of more financial resources, more technical support, in whatever way, form, or shape possible, so Iran can continue extending this exemplary, hospitality.
That's all for today. Thank you from the whole team. Please do tune in same time next week and each week after. Don't forget to leave your comments and topic requests. Till next time, take care.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
The credit rating agency Fitch has downgraded the U.S. government's top credit rating on Tuesday, 1st of August, a move that drew an angry response from the White House. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. National broadcaster CBS News has covered the story and tells us more. Fitch Ratings has downgraded U.S. credit from the highest rating, citing the nation's growing debt and its eroding political stability. In Fitch's view, there has been a steady deterioration in standards of governance over the last 20 years, including on fiscal and debt matters, the ratings agency said on Tuesday, 1st of August. The repeated debt limit political standoffs and last-minute resolutions have eroded confidence in fiscal management in the United States. The rating agency also cited the U.S.'s complex budgeting process and its lack of a medium-term financial planning relative to its peers in explaining the downgrade to AA+ from the U.S.'s previous AAA level. These factors, combined with the fiscal shocks from the pandemic, new spending and tax cuts, have brought the debt to 113% of the national economic output, well above pre-pandemic levels. The Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen described the new credit rating, calling it arbitrary and baseless on outdated data. Fitch's decision does not change what Americans, investors, and people all around the world already know, that Treasury's securities remain the world's preeminent safe and liquid asset, and that the American economy is fundamentally strong, Janet Yellen said in a statement that touted the U.S.'s economic recovery from the coronavirus recession and the administration's plans to reduce the budget deficit. Reduced credit ratings could lead the U.S. to pay higher interest rates on Treasury notes, on bills and bonds, according to the Associated Press. We strongly disagree with this decision, White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre said in a statement. The ratings model used by Fitch declined under President Trump and then improved under President Biden, and it defies reality to downgrade the United States at a moment when President Biden has delivered the strongest recovery of any major economy in the world. The United States last faced a downgrade in 2011 when Standard & Poor's cut the nation's credit rating one notch after prolonged wrangling in Congress brought the U.S. close to a debt default. The website npr.org National Public Radio has also covered the same story. Fitch Ratings cut the United States' credit rating by one notch from the top-rated AAA to AA+, saying rising deficits and political brinkmanship are imperiling the U.S. government's ability to pay its debts. The downgrade comes just 2 months after the Biden administration and House Republicans agreed to suspend the government's debt ceiling in a last-minute deal, narrowly avoiding a potentially disastrous federal default. It marks another rebuke for the United States, which lost its AAA rating from Standard & Poor's back in 2011, in the midst of another debt ceiling standoff. Today, only one of the three major credit rating agencies, Moody's Investors Service, gives the United States a top-notch AAA rating. Fitch acknowledged the strength of the U.S. economy and the advantages convened by the dollar's role as the world's most important currency. But the credit rating agency warned of mounting red ink and an unwillingness in both political parties to grapple with long-term fiscal challenges, while expressing little confidence in the U.S. government's ability to manage the country's finances. In Fitch's view, there has been a steady deterioration in standards of governance in the United States over the last 20 years, including on fiscal and debt matters, the credit rating agency said in announcing the downgrade. The repeated debt limit political standoffs and last-minute resolutions have eroded confidence in fiscal management in the United States. The move drew swift pushback from the Biden administration. The U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen called it arbitrary and based on outdated information. Fitch's decision does not change what Americans, investors, and people all around the world already know, Janet Yellen said in a statement. Treasury securities remain the world's preeminent safe and liquid asset, and the American economy is fundamentally strong. Fitch notes that spending limits adopted as part of the debt deal, clinched in June, cover only a small fraction of the overall budget and don't address long-term challenges, in financing Social Security and Medicare for an aging population. Tax cuts and government spending have led to widening government deficits in recent years, and with rising interest rates, the cost of bridging that gap has increased. Government interest payments in the first 9 months of the fiscal year totaled $652 billion, a 25% increase from the same period a year earlier. Today's downgrade should be a wake-up call, said Maya McGuinness, president of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. Maya McGuinness added, "We are clearly on an unsustainable fiscal path, and we need to do better." The British newspaper The Guardian has also covered the same story. Rating agency Fitch downgraded the US government's top credit rating on Tuesday, 1st of August, a move that drew an angry response from the Biden White House and surprised investors. Fitch downgraded the United States to AA+ from its AAA rating, citing fiscal deterioration over the next 3 years and repeated down-the-wire debt ceiling negotiations that threaten the US government's ability to pay its bills. It is the second major rating agency after Standard & Poor's to strip the United States of its AAA rating. Fitch had first flagged the possibility of a downgrade back in May amid the US debt ceiling negotiations, then maintained that position in June after the crisis was resolved, saying it intended to resolve the review in the third quarter of this year. After the announcement, the US dollar fell across a range of currencies, stock futures ticked down and Treasury futures rose. But several investors and analysts said they expected the impact of the downgrade to be limited. The move came despite the resolution of the US debt ceiling crisis 2 months ago. Joe Biden and the Republican-controlled House of Representatives reached a debt ceiling agreement in May, following months of political brinkmanship and wrangling. The deal lifted the government's $31.4 trillion borrowing limit. In Fitch's view, there has been a steady deterioration in standards of governance in the United States over the last 20 years, including on fiscal and debt matters, notwithstanding the June bipartisan agreement to suspend the debt limit until January of 2025. The rating agency said in a statement, "The repeated debt limit political standoffs and last-minute resolutions have eroded confidence in fiscal management by the U.S. government," it said. Janet Yellen, the U.S. Treasury Secretary, said she disagreed with Fitch's downgrade in a statement that calls it arbitrary and based on outdated data. The Biden White House had a similar view, saying it's with this decision. "It defies reality to downgrade the United States at the moment when President Biden has delivered the strongest recovery of any major economy in the world," said Karine Jean-Pierre, the White House's press secretary. Investors use credit ratings to assess the risk profile of companies and governments when they raise financing in the debt capital market. Generally, the lower a borrower's credit rating, the higher its financing costs.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The viewpoints of the leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, about Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and the tragedy of Karbala. Why are you disseminating sadness, crying and tears among people? They complain. This is not sadness and tears for the sake of sadness and tears. This is for the sake of the values. The things that lie behind the lamentation, beating the chest and the head, and shedding tears are the dearest things that one might find in the treasure trove of humanity, and they are the divine spiritual values. The Shias are trying to uphold the fact that Hussein ibn Ali alayhi salam is the epitome of all these values. The Shias are trying to keep their memories alive. And if the Muslim Ummah keeps Imam al-Hussein's name and memory alive and follows him, it will overcome all the obstacles and hardships. And that is why all of us in the Islamic Revolution, in the Islamic Republic, from the highest to the lowest echelons, including the people, the authorities, the senior officials, and our honorable Imam, have relied on the issue of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and the issue of Ashura and people's mourning. The mourning has a symbolic as well as a realistic aspect. It binds hearts together and broadens knowledge.
Ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana latshan.
Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, made the army of reason overcome the army of ignorance.
I would like to discuss a point regarding the efforts to promote Islam in the month of Muharram. Some people may question the value of the ceremonies for the mourning for Imam al-Hussein's martyrdom. They may say, if you want to speak about Imam al-Hussein's movement, just go ahead and speak about his movement. Why all the crying? This is a wrong assumption. It will be extremely hard to move ahead on this path in the absence of this emotional connection through the infallible imams. This is why Imam Khomeini recommended the traditional forms of mourning. The Quranic verses about the role of the infallible imams are interpreted in three different ways. Velaya is one of these interpretations. Your guardian can only be Allah and His messenger and those who believe, who establish worship and pay charity and bow down in prayer. The Holy Quran, Surah 5, Ayah 55.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Leaving Lebanon's economy with an almost total economic meltdown, Riyad Salemi has stepped down as the governor of the central bank. The central bank's newly appointed acting governor, Wasim Mansouri, on Monday called on the government to implement a capital control law, a financial restructuring law, and a 2023 state budget within 6 months.
We were able to convince the government that the subsidies policy needs to stop, and as a result, management improved, and the economy relatively began to recover. However, the government's need for the U.S. dollar continues, since the only way to end the government's reliance on the central bank was to improve public finances. The problem is not monetary, and the solution is not with the central bank. The main issue is in the financial policies of the state, and there needs to be a clear decision to improve general management.
He stressed that the bank would impose restrictions on when to lend money to the government. Salemi was for years credited for economic recovery following Lebanon's civil war, yet now he is being investigated by at least 7 countries, including Lebanon, for embezzlement and illicit enrichment. He denies the accusations. A former advisor to 3 central bank governors in Lebanon tells Press TV that Salemi was merely following the U.S. policies.
He was implementing the U.S. policies, and U.S. policies since the end of World War II stipulated that the countries of the Third World are prohibited from development. They only allowed Korea and Taiwan to prosper since they want to confront China and Russia, but they also supported Israel in this region and even prevented Egypt from becoming an industrial nation.
The problem, he believes, is a problem of mismanagement as well as in the structure of the policies, which bound the Lebanese lira to the U.S. dollar.
He pegged the price of the Lebanese lira to the U.S. dollar, saying that this would stabilize the lira, but this was a catastrophic mistake, which I had warned against. The U.S. dollar itself is not stable, so pegging the lira to the U.S. dollar won't make it stable. We needed to peg our currency to a basket of currencies based on imports to Lebanon. This impacted Lebanon's ability to compete in the global markets.
The current financial crisis began in 2019 when the value of the Lebanese lira plummeted and inflation soared in the Arab country. After 30 years in his post, Lebanon's former central bank governor is seen by many experts as being the main orchestrator of the financial and monetary policies, which led to an abrupt collapse. However, there are also speculations that he couldn't have done it without collaboration from the country's political elite. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
The Arab woman who took on 2 far-right activists in a bid to save a Quran from desecration in Denmark has been identified. Iraqi-Danish citizen Quds al-Samarai risked her own life while en route to visit a friend on Monday, the 24th of July. The footage of the incident, which occurred outside Iraq's embassy, went viral on social media. The video clearly shows Quds grabbing the Quran before being wrestled to the ground by the 2 men. In one instance, one of the desecrators can be seen with his hands reaching for her neck. Police later arrested Quds on accusations she was stealing the Quran from the activists. Speaking to Press TV, Quds explained how the incident left her with minor injuries, but no regrets.
Here the police dragged me, and the man was shouting that I stole his property.
I think he was scared because he knew hitting me was wrong, so he had to justify it by saying I stole. As soon as the police heard the word stealing, they immediately put me in handcuffs and gave him back the Quran. The police asked me what happened. I said I saw our Quran being burned, and I just wanted to put it out, and then I saw